Very nice to be with you this morning. I already consider my morning a success. I don't usually have anybody walk the aisle when I'm preaching. I've already had Heather's little friend come forward. Okay, we can all go home now happy. I actually admit a little panic as I pulled in your parking lot this morning at 8:45, and it was pretty much full. It had been long enough that I've been here. I forget you arrived this early. I wondered if I'd misread the website and the service really started at 8:30 or something. Okay. So that just shows it's been a little while since I've been here, and I think I've been spoiled over the years getting here on a fairly regular basis, almost every year there for a while, and we've had some things interrupt that here recently just a bit, but it's nice to be back. And I have to say that in my line of work, when I go to a congregation, if I get invited back at all, it's maybe some years later, so all this kind of makes us best friends, I just want to say. We can seal the relationship by liking each other on Facebook, I guess, or something like that. So we at New Community Project deeply appreciate this relationship. It's nice to have friends that we can count friends, and I mean truly as friends. And also many of you and the congregation as a whole gives us material support, and that means a lot to us. Small organization like ours really benefits from support from folks like yourselves, especially as things are kind of going well for us and we're finding ourselves sort of moving on out into some new areas. Schools and colleges. Heather mentioned a little about my work in that regard, but more and more places like that are inviting me or my associate Tom out in Virginia to come and speak. And you know, you don't always get paid in those situations. And that's not the bottom line, really. The key is to be there. Because really, the fields are ripe unto harvest with young people. And you know, we've got to catch them early. And we got to sow those seeds of discontent with the consumer culture, and those seeds of compassion and caring and consciousness of the world around us. And kids are ready for this. I find, actually, on this trip to starting in Pennsylvania and then coming out here to Indiana, 12-day trip, I guess I'm going to speak 22 times to school groups. From first graders, which will be tomorrow, to pre-med students, which was day before yesterday at University of St. Francis. And not only are they receptive, but I find young kids especially very responsive. I was in Southern California near La Verne speaking to a cafeteria full of sixth graders last spring, mostly a Hispanic area, and so lots of Hispanic kids in the crowd there, but going through my stories and pictures and statistics and, you know, talking about our fossil fuel use and how what that's doing to the climate. They asked me to talk about that, the teachers did. So at the end, I asked them for their ideas about what they could do to cut back on their own energy consumption, and shorter showers, said one. Turn off my computer game when I'm finished, said another. And then a boy in the second row with a crew cut spoke up and said, hide my parents' car keys? Which I said, good idea, just don't tell them I said so. Okay. We're also expanding in other ways. We just started supporting girls' education and women's tailoring training in the Congo, working with that fledgling Church of the Brethren group there. You may know that this East African country has had a 20-year civil war, 5 million people killed, the most deadly conflict since World War II in our world, and a lot of people, it's not on our radar screens. And also, there's been tremendous violence against women. In fact, they have called it the war against women in this country in East Africa. So we felt like it was kind of the right place to be. And we hope to take a group there, learning tour group at some point in the not too distant future. Maybe another of you could come along with us on that trip. And we were contacted last year about this time about opening a second sustainable living center. We have one in Virginia in Harrisonburg area. I don't know if any of you visited there, but if you get up the Valley of Virginia, we'd love for you to stop in there in Harrisonburg to visit. Anyway, another one, this one in a foreign land, Vermont. It is to me anyway. Well, this past January, our new staff person, Pete Antos Ketchum, began his work there, starting off at a day a week. We're edging him in sort of gracefully and gently, partly for financial reasons and partly just to see how it goes. And along with his environmental and social justice credentials, he also makes maple syrup, which wasn't the only reason we hired him. But you know, it couldn't hurt, could it? I learned a lot on my visit up there. The first time I've been there, last month, I learned a lot on my visit. For instance, it takes 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of maple syrup, which was news to me, and a lot of boiling, as we said in Virginia, a lot of boiling. I also learned that winters there are you know, gradually getting warmer. In fact, on average, it's about 3 degrees warmer in the winter in Vermont than it would have been 25, 30 years ago. And thanks to that, deer ticks now survive the winter in more, or actually can survive the winters. Deer ticks didn't used to live in that part of the world. They're moving north now, migrating as winters warm up, and they can stand the winters. And so now, and they, of course, bring with them Lyme disease. So now a walk in the woods or a trip out to gather your maple sap can have repercussions of contracting Lyme disease, which is a fairly serious illness, I believe. It's even worse for another North Woods resident, the moose. These 1,500-pound creatures have always attracted what they call winter ticks up there. But now there are lots more of these ticks because the winters aren't cold enough to kill off the larvae. They're over-multiplying. They go for their favorite food source, which is the moose, up to 150,000 of these ticks per moose, sucking the life out of these behemoths. And now they're saying the moose population along the upper tier of the lower 48, Minnesota, Montana, Maine, Vermont, where they live, is in decline by 8, 10, 12% a year. And of course, this is not the moose's fault. I mean, they're dealing with things that we've set in motion, and they're sort of on the receiving end of the trauma and the tragedy. So God's creation is struggling. I guess today there are only half as many living creatures on the planet as there were when I was in high school about 40 years ago, something like that. Half as many living creatures. They're gone. Because, well, and maybe not coincidentally, human population has doubled in that time. Well, we can be grateful that at least there's still a robust population of man-eating tigers. Maybe you saw this report this week. Man-eating tigers in certain coastal areas of India where there are mangrove swamps. These man-eating tigers sort of, I guess not every tiger is a man-eater unless you get in its path. I don't know how this works. But these are specifically, and they've killed some people, I guess about 100 over the last couple of years. But it keeps people out of those forests. And if it weren't for the man-eating tigers, the report went on, these mangrove swamps would be gone by now. People would have, quote, developed them with farms and shrimp operations and who knows what else. And as it turns out, these mangrove swamps provide a critical buffer. As sea levels rise around the world, including along the coastal areas of India, these mangrove swamps kind of keep the sea levels at bay, keep the soil and the coastlines intact, and also absorb quite a bit of CO2, which of course is causing all this. So nature can be our friend if we let it. As we care for the planet can care for us. It's something we know, but we sure don't practice it that well. And of course, even as we flourish, we humans flourish numerically, many of us, millions of us struggle. We talked about Nigeria just a moment ago. I mentioned Congo just a while ago. And during Sunday school, I'll be sharing stories and photos from our January and February trips to Myanmar and South Sudan, two of the poorest nations in the world. So, since the outside world has recently lifted its economic embargo against Myanmar, their military government's loosening up a little bit. The clothing corporations are moving in, we learned, when we were there in January. They say they want to give Burmese an opportunity, a job opportunity. Well, the daily wage for the women working in these garment factories is going to be $1 for 11 days' work. Excuse me, 11 hours. $1 for 11 hours' work. And I guess I would ask, who's helping who in that particular situation? During Sunday school, I have some options for you. If we want to help these young women have a different kind of future and different opportunities, we're at least trying to work in our small way at offering some of those. And then South Sudan. Conflict, poverty, gender inequality, early marriages, a lethal combination that means that only 1% of South Sudanese girls graduate from high school. And of course, that has long-term repercussions not only for them, but for their new nation, I guess the newest nation in the world, South Sudan, as of about 5 years ago. And need we mention, you know, Ferguson, North Charleston, Nigeria, Syria, Iraq. We have an Iraqi refugee family at our center out in Virginia. We have a special house that we've reserved for refugees from the world's conflicts. And this family moved, a Muslim family, has moved in there for the last 6 months or so. You know, I think we went to Iraq thinking about liberation. It has turned into exodus. Hundreds of thousands of Christians and Muslims having to leave their own country because of the chaos that has ensued. In fact, when I was over at University of St. Francis on Friday giving a speech, I mentioned that and just said, just in kind of in passing, really. And a young man came up to me after the presentation and said, well, I was there. And I had told him in the presentation I had been there in 2001. He said I was there as part of our military operation, and I was in Afghanistan. We talked about it for a few minutes, and the end of our conversation, he sort of said, I'm not sure we left things any better than we found it. In fact, maybe worse. And I thought, from this young man who's invested quite a bit of his life and maybe risked his life in that situation, to realize that maybe we didn't do the good we thought we were going to do. I took quite a bit of self-reflection. Oh, well, so anyway, we continue to face many challenges in our world, as everybody in this congregation knows. We don't have our heads in the sand in the Church of the Brethren. We're willing to look up and look away and see what's going on in the world around us, so much so that it's sometimes a challenge to keep hope alive, at least for those of us who care enough to look up from our cup of cappuccino to see what in the world is going on behind the headlines. When you think about that trade deal they're trying to sign right now, which is simply going to make things continue right in the way they are, the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, as we skew things in the favor of the corporations around the world. Anyway, to see the true predicament of our planet and its people, this is something not a lot of people take time to do, and I've always appreciated the fact that we in the Church of the Brethren seem to be willing to do that. We could use a dose of hope. Anytime you do that, you're going to need a dose of hope to look out on a world like this and feel some confidence that you can move ahead and make some kind of a difference. Not unlike the disciples the week after the Friday before. They had pretty much put all their Easter eggs in the Jesus basket. And in the days leading up to the events of that bitter Friday, I mean, we call it Good Friday, but you know what? At the time, it was Bitter Friday. At the time leading up to that bitter Friday, they had every reason to be optimistic. There was growing enthusiasm and excitement from the crowds. There had been innovating encounters in the temple with the religious authorities, and those same authorities seemingly shrinking before the adoring masses that followed Jesus' every move seemed to incapacitate them to do what they wanted to do to Jesus. If the polls were to be believed, Jesus' victory seemed inevitable, and their seats, the disciples' seats in the new government, all but guaranteed. And you remember, in those days leading up to these events of Holy Week, they were jockeying for a position in the cabinet, if you remember. And then, in a matter of hours, a somber supper, Judas' betrayal, the kangaroo court, early morning conviction, and the ascension, not to a throne, but to a hill called Golgotha. Well, where do you go from there? I guess fishing. I'm sure you could affirm that, David. I guess fishing. Back to what you know. A sort of chicken soup, or we might say fish chowder for the soul. Not knowing what else to do, where else to turn, the disciples settled back into some semblance of the routines of their famous familiar routines after the run for the championship ended in a crushing defeat. Back to their boats. And yet, hadn't he said something about meeting up with them again in Galilee after this had all come down? Nah. But they went into the water anyway, maybe with one eye turned toward the shore, just in case. Before they knew it, there he was, chilling and grilling on the lake shore. And they were off and running, and we have now been for 2,000 years. So where do we look? If we likewise could benefit from our rendezvous with our risen Lord, if we too are at times depressed that things in our world haven't gone as we had hoped, and certainly they haven't, and certainly they don't, where is our lake shore? Where do we turn to look? Well, you know, Jesus gave us some clues. For one, he said we'd find him in the poor, the imprisoned, the hungry, the naked, those on the outside of society looking in. So that might be one place to start. Kind of reminds me of Melissa. She showed up at our site in downtown Harrisonburg right after it opened about 4 years ago. Addicted, abused, out of options. She was one of the first residents of what we call now Spring House, our sort of group home for anybody who's looking for a place to live. The ill, the well, young adults looking for the meaning of life, they show up there and form a community there together. Well, the community had to work hard to figure out how to how to work with Melissa. She had many needs. But now she's helping us. As it turned out, they welcomed her into the fellowship, put her to work in the gardens. She welcomed her into the spiritual rhythms of the community. She experienced something of a resurrection herself. She's been high and dry, off chemicals, off cigarettes for 3 years now. And now she's a core member of the community with a real knack for helping others who come into the community from her own former predicament. Who are the Melissas around us? Certainly with needs, but also just as surely with gifts that may surprise us and remind us that Christ is among us to renew and resurrect, maybe when we least expect it. Where else do we look? Well, after the resurrection, Jesus remet his followers on numerous occasions in the breaking of bread. And you can recall those stories. The intimacy of a meal brings sometimes unexpected revelations. Some of you remember Clyde Weaver. He was the marketing director for Brethren Press back in the, I think, 70s and 80s. I'm not really sure. Perhaps most famous or infamous for the corny jokes he used at annual conference to sell the wares of Brethren Press. He always got a laugh and a groan when he would tell the jokes up there on the stage of annual conference. Clyde also had a deep concern for peace in our world, especially there in the deep chill of the Cold War, as some of you lived through that. In cooperation with New Call to Peacemaking, he undertook a populist, you might say, form of peacemaking. He began a series of choir exchanges, and possibly he visited congregations in Fort Wayne, I don't really know, but he began a series of choir exchanges. He would bring the choir from Moscow Baptist Church, you might say the heart of the empire, the evil empire as we called it back then, in the heart of the evil empire. He would bring the choir from the Moscow Baptist Church to the United States to tour Brethren, Mennonite, and Quaker congregations, and then take a choir from here there to tour congregations. Now he saw this kind of people-to-people exchange as one of the best ways to thaw the big chill between our respective peoples. Well, when the Russians came here, he took them from congregation to congregation by bus. And he didn't put them up in hotels. This was part of the genius of the plan. He's had them stay with families. So after a concert, the host families would arrive back at the bus. They would divide up the Russian choir, take them out to various homes. They would maybe give them a snack in the evening, put them up overnight, feed them breakfast in the morning, then bring them back to bus first thing so they could head off to the next tour location, wherever that was. Well, Clyde told me that on one of those mornings, as he waited by the bus and families began dropping off the Russians that they had hosted, one Brethren man said goodbye to his guest and saw him onto the bus, then pulled Clyde aside and said, "You know, before last night, I thought that all Russians were evil, devilish, really. But then as we shared last evening and then had breakfast together this morning, I realized that they are people just like us. God's children all." And he broke down in tears. Christ is among us. As we open ourselves to each other across the many lines that would divide us, and tearful transformations may not be far behind. And we recall another place that the risen Lord appeared on that glorious Easter morning. You remember the garden within which the tomb lay, Mary mistaking Jesus for the gardener at one point. I guess I had a garden moment like that this past Good Friday, actually. What, about a little over 2 weeks ago? It all actually started about a year and a half ago. I had stopped by to visit Grace Lefevre. Some of you may know that name. David does, maybe others. In her 90s, from Spring Grove, Pennsylvania, she and her husband pioneers in the natural food movement back in the 70s and 80s, when before it was vogue. She told me on one of my visits to see her that they started off in a closet in their house. And you know, that's often how these things emerge. These good ideas, they take shape where you can put them. So they were selling natural foods out of their closet. Then they had a big organic farm they established, and finally a big storefront out on the main route there in Spring Grove. Also a member of the West York Church of the Brethren and lifelong Christian peacemaker. She was also famous for her weed walks Have you heard of them? Where she would take people around her property and identify and sample edible weeds. If you can eat it, is it still a weed? I don't know. It kind of becomes our friend in that situation. Anyway, she and I had been friends for a decade or more, as we had some of these common interests, as she would with some of you. And I stopped by to visit fall before last. And as I stopped in, she insisted that I have lunch with her, soup and weed salad. A little of her homemade dressing, and it was pretty good, I have to say. Then we toured her greenhouse to see what was up, so to speak, what she was growing, getting ready for next spring's planting. And then it was time for me to leave. And as I got ready to depart, she insisted that I take some celery shoots from the greenhouse along with me. Well, I was game. We've got two irrigated raised bed gardens in our backyard in Peoria, Arizona. I've never grown celery. I kind of like to have some celery around the house just for different casseroles and peanut butter and however else you want to use celery. Celery is fairly expensive sometimes in the store, and plus it's hard to use it all up before it becomes rubbery. Do you know what I'm talking about here? So I thought, okay, I'm up for this, although I was a little skeptical. This was Arizona. It was not Pennsylvania. But nevertheless, I took it gratefully and took it with me, even got it through airport security. I don't know what they thought, but nobody raised any questions. So I wrapped them up in some moist towels that I'd found, and they made it all the way home. We planted them in the garden. This must have been, you know, October-ish or something. A few didn't make it, but others did. So far, so good. Now, summer was still around the bend. Well, then a few months later, last spring, actually, I got the news that Grace wasn't doing well. In fact, she might be in her last days with us. She'd had an accident of some kind. There'd been some other sort of head and heart things going on, not sure exactly what. Well, I happened to be in the area not long after I heard that news and felt like I needed to pay her what might be a final visit. I planned to go on a Sunday afternoon after I was speaking at a church actually in York. Her place was only 8 or 10 miles from there. I thought I'll stop by after the service. Then more than one person told me when they heard what I was intending to do that they thought maybe she had already passed away. Well, you do what you always do in a situation like that. I did a web search looking for an obituary. I couldn't find one, so that raised a grain of doubt. And maybe she was still with us. So I decided to go there. I didn't call or anything. I just wanted to go. So I went to their house, or her house, and I arrived, and her daughter and her friend were in the kitchen. That's where you kind of enter the house. And so I said my hellos. And again, at this point, I wasn't sure if she was alive or dead. But you can ask enough sort of teasing questions, leading questions, that you can figure these things out. And in a few moments, I realized that she was indeed alive in the back room in her bed in kind of a hospice situation. Well, I asked if I could spend a few moments with her just to sort of give my greeting and say my goodbye. And her daughter said, sure. So I went back there and entered her room, and her eyes caught sight of me as I came in and followed me all through our few minutes together. That was the only response I got, but anyway, I told her how much I appreciated her and her work, how much really I loved her and respected her, and that the celery she had given me the fall before was still alive and well. I also told her a little story about my granddaughter who's picking up on some of these things. I thought Grace would want to hear that there's another generation coming after us that cares. Well, I said my goodbyes, and a few days later I got the news that she had passed away. Well, summer in Arizona rolled around, last summer now. Most of our garden withered under that hot sun. It could be 114 or more. Things bake before you get them in the kitchen, if you know what I'm saying. So the celery faded, brown and desiccated, and all but vanished by mid-July. All but. Come October, it began to revive. Actually, with a vengeance. It populated that whole bed, the whole perimeter of that bed. Then it jumped ship over into the asparagus patch. Then it moved out into our lawn, aka the unirrigated rocks we call our yard, and began to populate itself there, somehow thriving, I would say, almost miraculously. And this past Good Friday, when I walked out there in the morning, that morning sun coming across our lawn, illuminating that celery as it made its way all across our lawn, I thought, these ideas, this faith in a new and better day, these countercultural but kingdom-centered values and principles and practices, they will not be done in so easily. They survive against the odds, and even against our even fondest dreams and hopes, perhaps. They survive and thrive. Where, O death, is now thy victory? Where, O death, is now thy sting? I'm not given to taunts, but I kind of like that one. Why do we seek the living among the dead? The angel asked that morning at the tomb. Because we know death hath not the final word. In this world or the next, and that though often our hopes seem dashed, and we might say desiccated, they are not destroyed. Not so long as God is God. Not so long as Christ is risen and among us. Not so long as we continue to meet him in the least and the last, in the breaking of bread, in our mundane but marvelous and sometimes miraculous daily routines. So long as we keep one eye turned toward the shore, hoping against hope that he will appear just as he promised, and just when we need it most. May it be so. Amen and happy Easter.